Hey, what's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. That music you are hearing underneath me is made by my guest today, Lindsay Sandwald, also known as Iggy Dean. She's a fascinating, awesome artist, and I am so lucky to call her a classmate here at Harvard Divinity School. And I gotta say, conversations like these is one of my favorite parts of being here so far, and I look forward to having more of these. There's just so many people with so many different backgrounds. I am truly humbled and blown away. And I look forward to more of these conversations with more of my classmates. Anyway, that's all the intro I'm going to give for today. Go to iggydean.com for more of her music. Check her out wherever you can check out music. Go to chooseyourownreligion.com for other episodes of this podcast. And take care of yourself. Here's Lindsay Sandwald, a.k.a. Iggy Dean.
Affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best, and I hope that you choose your own religion.
And put
like this, like reflection thing. You can kind of see us.
Amazing.
Anyway, no, this is fun. I did record one time on top of a mountain as like my last episode before I left LA, but most of them were in my apartment. But this is like the second. This is like the third or fourth on location one.
On locations are fun.
It is fun.
It's like
it does feel like a
travel
bit of
a show.
Yeah, exactly. It does feel a bit like a challenge because I don't have my normal like soundboard, so yeah. I feel like I'm Bruce Springsteen recording Nebraska, but like outside in Manhattan.
We're in the bathroom of a McDonald's. We are in.
No,
the
but
element.
We are on Harvard property right now.
Yeah,
the Smith Campus Center. Which is cool.
That continues
weird.
To be one of my, for all of the emotional roller coaster of these first few weeks.
Yeah.
The one thing that's like constant is every time, because do you live around here?
Somerville, so 20-minute walk.
All right. I'm over the river in Brookline.
Uh huh.
So it's always like a journey.
Mm.
But every time I come in here, I'm just like, what?
It's surreal.
This is what?
Are you so you're still with that like, oh, this is so weird, like.
Yeah, but I love it.
It's cool.
I had my first, I mean, orientation was just orientation for me was like hyper overcharged because I was also in the process of like training at a new job and like wrapping up my life in New York.
You like just moved too, right?
I hadn't even moved here during orientation.
Oh,
I like played a really big show, packed an overnight bag.
Oh my God.
Drove here, interviewed for two jobs, did the 3 days of orientation, started training at the new job, took a bus back, packed up like my house,
oh
got
my
in a
God.
U-Haul with my cat and came here and then started class.
You know, so. I remember seeing you in orientation. I feel like you really undersold what you were going through. I'll be honest. I'd like listened to a little bit of your music beforehand. I was like, oh shit, this is good. I do want to talk a lot about that later. I was like trying not to geek out about it. I'm like, be cool, man. But then you had a very healthy rock star vibe about you. I don't even know what that means.
Well, I think of myself as the rock star, but my proper oversoul ego recognizes that I'm like a nobody. So you're just boosting my hot air balloon.
I'm boosting the wrong ego here.
But it's good because then I was going to say that the first week of orientation was almost like an altered state. Like I wasn't even in any sort of actual capacity to like judge what was happening.
Mm.
And then like the first week or two, I don't even know what week we're on, I think four.
I was
so blissed out. I felt like I had this like invincible armor of gratitude on.
Wow.
Where like even though everybody was like, it was still like high stakes, but I didn't have to like move. Like some of the big, literal big heavy lifting was behind me. So at that point I could just be like, I had just all the space to be like, oh my God, like I'm a student at fucking Harvard.
Yeah.
Like this is awesome. And also I felt like no bones about having to prove anything or have an agenda. I just felt so present in myself of being like, I'm just here because I want to learn.
That's awesome. And how are you
and
now?
And that has since waned a little
bit.
Yeah,
I was about to say, yeah.
Well, that has waned due to just having my, like, can I curse on this?
Yeah.
Having my ass handed to me, please. Like, yeah. Assignments. And, like, having some intense, like, I had, like, my first mini tantrum of, like, missing New York, where I was, like, looking to get a bodega coconut water late at night, and that doesn't exist here. And
yeah, I have found myself in a comparing mind a lot recently. And it's not just because it's getting cold for the first time in a decade for me.
Oh,
but,
my God. Oh,
but,
you're in for it.
Yeah, I know. God, I know. believe me, I know. But I have been in that, like, in that comparing mind as a judging mind. You know, it's like, oh, this isn't exactly what I envisioned it. Of course, it wouldn't be exactly
right.
It never is exactly what you think the future is going to look like. It never is.
And also, like, a thing I have to, like, keep reminding myself, like, we signed up for the trial. So, like, even when I catch myself being like, oh, my God, I have, like, so much homework. And this is crazy. And I'm just like, bitch, this is what you wanted.
Right.
Like, this is, how lucky are you?
What did you think it was going to be like?
How lucky, and, like, have to, like, remind myself, how lucky are you? But then I felt like,
you know,
sort of, like, fever pitch intensity of everybody. And I've sort of, like, pitted myself. I don't want to say pitted because I don't want to be, like, confrontational or, like, aggressive. But I've sort of... I'll just say it. I've pitted myself against, like, the more our other, I don't want to, like, incriminate other cohort, but our cohort is sort of split down the middle of, like, devotional practitioners and heavy academic driven.
Right. We have the academic focus and academic degree who are more like going into, they're taking that, some might say the critical approach to religion. And then we have those of us who are in the MDiv, Master of Divinity program, who are that devotional practice.
Shiny, happy people holding hands.
Right, that, like, wanting to, like, be and ultimately do this as a vocation to some degree or to, like, be some maybe an advocate for our thing. I have been dealing with the cynicism, what I have perceived as cynicism or ultra-criticism, and I'm like, man. And it's like, made me, it feels like it's made me more that way, but then... I had a section today with all academic all MTS people.
Yeah,
that's academic focused people. Yeah,
friends and love many of them.
And they were all very lovely, all very like, happy, pleasant, wonderful people.
Of course, and like we need them just as much as they need us. I think.
Oh, that's for damn sure.
And what I was gonna say is like for those first 2 weeks where I had like the shining armor of gratitude on, I sort of was like, oh, look at them with. Look at them with their focus, what they think they're going to do. They haven't yet realized that that's not what any of this is about. And then more recently, me being caught up in like, and being like, wait a second. I was outside of that and I didn't need that. And so I'm like, had to remind myself.
I've certainly had to. This has really been the most present thing on my mind the past couple of days is like, it has been a challenge to do my gratitude practice more than usual. I think it's ultimately a good thing. That's the cool part about a gratitude practice where it's like if you practice saying thank you for literally anything and everything, then it's like then it forces you to figure out, all right, how am I going to be thankful for this, including how am I going to be thankful for having struggles with my gratitude practice, right?
Yeah.
So it's like if I can get through an environment that – and by the way, again, all pleasant people – and if I'm in when I'm in communities and I've church shopped a lot in my life, when I'm in places where I feel like there's no critical thinking and zero groundedness, that bothers me too, and it's dangerous. So then I'm like, please, more MTS people.
Yeah.
But then I think what I'm struggling with is like it feels. I'm such a heart person, and that sounds lame to say, or it sounds whatever to say. Maybe it sounds a certain amount of ego, but it's not about ego. It's just like.
No, we're in a safe space. I'm basically talking about pitting ourselves.
No, I'm just saying as a method, though, as a method, I feel I'm a Ram Dass follower at the end of the day. Yeah. He's one of my main teachers as far as like things I've picked up from, which is the mind is a wonderful servant but a terrible master.
Yeah.
And that that the mind is great. We need it.
Right.
We need it to accomplish everything, basically. Mm. We need it to figure out things, and we need it to safeguard us against the perils of irrationality,
right,
and whatnot. But at the end of the day, I feel like my heart has to kind of be driving.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be anyway. Yeah.
Well, and that's why, like, you know, in terms of like expectations of this program or look, now I sound like an MTS. My expectations for my time here. I was so attracted. I was suddenly divinely attracted to divinity school precisely because I wanted and was craving a space where I could have the agency and the authority to talk about God and like the spiritual experience and have this sort of like upgrade aspect of it that wasn't just like, oh, there's the yoga teacher talking about energy and being like, no, bitch, I'm talking about God here. Like,
right. Or like being able to at least like quote more like scripture and stuff or whatever it is.
Yeah, or just to be like, because I mean, I don't come from a Christian background, mm-hmm. but the way I've like narrated it to people is basically I didn't grow up with any sort of church tradition.
Hmm.
Desperately wanted one as a child. Like, I remember being young and like asking my parents, like, can I go to church? It's like my friends or synagogue? Like, I want a bat mitzvah. Like,
yeah.
Can I do this too?
Yeah.
And they're like, no. Like, trust us. You're fine. there's a God and do unto others and like always be honest, but like you're not interested in that.
Hmm.
And I like craved it, and then I went through like the sort of typical age 11 to 20 atheism. There is no God.
Sure, yeah.
You sheeple are all crazy.
Right.
And then I had like a very profound. It coincided when I started, I guess, practicing yoga, though that wasn't apparent in the beginning. But
yeah.
I was out on like a farm and just sort of had this like, you know, divine awakening. And then every year it's just been like incrementally expanding in some way. But I was going to say, in sort of a comic turn of events, more recently I've like come, there's like a bit of a rebel bone, not a bit, there's a big rebel bone in my body. And I've come back around to like church and particularly Christianity and like Jesus almost as like a rebel move.
Yes.
Where I'm just
I fucking relate to that so hard.
All y'all basic people are too cool for Jesus and think Christianity's a joke, but actually there's something here that I'm curious in exploring. And I feel like I'd have to be like mum about that with my hyper intellectual secular city friends. I don't know. I might even just be projecting that, because I do think there's like a sea change and like things are shifting.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be talking about something. Jesus still feels like a trigger word for so many people.
Uh-huh.
I know, even here, I mean,
for sure,
like
for
there's
sure.
plenty of people here that it's like you see their posture change, but that's one of the cool things about being here too, that just for how often is that's like perpetuating, there's just as many people where it's just like, all right, cool, we can like talk about this and know that it's not like a fundamentalist
yeah
bit that everybody's terrified of, but it's also can be this like freewheeling hyper vast conversation.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I even this past summer especially have been connected more, just realizing like, oh shit, I really am a Christian when push comes to shove.
Damn it.
This whole time, but I am like, as I like I've been joking, like I'm an open Christian, or like me and Jesus have an open relationship. Like we both see other people.
Yeah.
anyway.
He's very polyamorous.
He really is. You know, he's not jealous of me.
His whole thing is to get into everybody.
Imagine Jesus being like, well, okay, I guess there are some scripture stuff. Like, anyway, we don't have to get into that detail, but
we can.
Well, just like there are things like, you know, one can only know the Father through me. And it's been a long time since I've studied the New Testament, but I do know there are a lot of things that were likely added post hoc,
mm-hmm.
shall we say?
Yeah.
That were like, well, we need to make this kind of argument for why Jesus was either like an apocalypticist saying the world was about to end, or Jesus was totally God, or saying Jesus was totally human. So there's a lot of stuff that's kind of, we don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
What was authentically there or not. And it is a little bit of a challenge to figure out, like,
what was said by the real, quote unquote, real Jesus. Mm-hmm. Was there, yeah, what's the transcendent message even beyond right. that? But that's why I've taken, I say jokingly, it's a cop out, but like, I mystic Christianity is what I'm about.
Yeah.
And as far as like Same. Having a non-dualist approach, and as far as having a, to me, the mystic tradition, it doesn't run through necessarily every tradition out there, but it runs through a lot of them. And there's a lot of commonalities of this paradoxical, yes, there are real differences between me and you sitting here and me in this chair, and yet there's kind of not, too. Yeah.
Well, again, speaking as a complete novice to this stuff, like I've never studied the New Testament yet.
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait to hear.
I saw you in early Christian thought.
Well, I love
one.
Early Christian thought. I mean, yeah. That's like my favorite class. And we just finished reading on First Principles, and that first century Christian philosopher Origen.
Yeah, that's pretty early.
And
it's really
so,
early Christian. Yeah.
It's so aligned with what I feel to be like the truth, which is, you know, but the thing that and what I feel to be that truth is, you know, and with all the a lot of like yogis are about too, like Yogananda, who's the sort of the one of the patrons of the lineage I come from, has this whole tome, The Second Coming of Christ, and you know, which is basically like the Christ consciousness being mm-hmm. resurrected in you. So it's less about like this historical figure and
right.
working out literally all the like bone and flesh of who Jesus was as an actual human, and more about like no, this is about what's innate in all of us, and that's what Origen's talking about. But the thing that is very still a hang up for me, and I'm excited to like tease it out, is if so Origen's whole thing is like, you know, Christ consciousness belongs to all of us. We're all going to be saved eventually because we're all going to tap into it. And so it's like designed for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But then why all of this? There can only be one begotten son.
There can only be what?
One begotten son.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense, because if the name of the game is to get everybody on the like rehabilitation train, and we all want, and this is like this universal wisdom that
right.
we all are designed in our own time and ways to awaken to, why it's a very confusing message to be like, there was only one Jesus and he's only, there's
yeah.
only one way.
Yeah. I have literally no idea why Origen would believe that. I mean, I was thinking this summer about like, it's in, and I felt a certain amount of liberty as like, I guess I'm essentially a Christian Unitarian and a Christian Universalist. At the end of the day, meaning that like I kind of believe that like Christ is a certain messenger of a divine message, mm-hmm. but that it's not exactly Trinitarian, and also that everybody's saved at the end of the day, we're all going to be fine. Also, I don't, being saved, I don't even necessarily love that language
yeah,
either.
Yeah.
Anyway, everybody's good.
Yeah.
Everything's love. We're all made of love.
Yeah.
That's the now as
true story.
And being somewhat liberated from, to me, it feels like a liberation from having to like make it all quote unquote work.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's the history of a lot of theology, is like they were sort of confined by scripture, and also having to explain their own kind of intrinsic views about God and love and Jesus. And they're like, well, so it's like trying to draw these like crazy lines, or like trying to do these crazy dot connecting, like, well,
yeah,
okay, see, I can justify this with that, and because this person 500 years ago said it, that backs me up, and
right.
And it's like, it's very convoluted, and it feels like a little bit like an ego game to a certain
yes.
degree. And then you have these breakthrough moments where you have, I don't know, maybe famous theologians that I don't know nearly enough about yet to say who exactly where these breakthrough moments are, but like, you have these breakthrough moments where people are like, oh, actually, well, like Aquinas. I know Aquinas was a negative theology
guy.
I'm
also in that study right now, taking.
Aquinas was like, yeah, we can only really describe God by what God's not, because anytime we try to describe God, we just get away from describing God, mm-hmm. which is kind of Zen, in my opinion. But
Aquinas also is the, again, root situation of just like, if God is love, and that's like the most pure essence, and goodness, rather. Like, of course, because one of the big hang-up questions, just like, well, why would we be created in the first place? Why would these deviant, compromised, right. fallen beings be created? And it's just like, well, no, you were created because you were created out of like a spirit of generosity. Like, I'm full. If God is like this, just pure goodness, then goodness wants to be shared and multiplied.
Yeah, and like, while we're having this conversation, I'm like fascinated and terrified. Like, what will I, if I look back on this in like 3 years, yeah. I'm going to be like, what the fuck was I talking about?
Yes, no, this will be like a time capsule.
This is a time capsule.
Where I'm just like, ew, gross. But
it does get me back to like why I see all this stuff, even this I love it. It's entertaining to me, and it's like there is a certain satisfaction, but it also feels like this is like very mind gamey, yeah. right? That we're like trying to figure out how it all works versus like, just love everybody.
Well, I don't feel like I will say, and this might be totally false, but my sense is I don't feel like I'm trying to figure how it's all working out. I'm more interested, if any sort of active part of me, the action that I'm interested in cultivating is being a participant, not being like a, oh, so this is how this all works. Like, the more I like surrender to just like accepting the scenarios that I am like manifesting,
yeah.
or gravitating towards or whatever, like the more I feel there, and that's been sort of kind of challenging for me in the classes too, because in my spiritual communities, again, that's sort of a little bit more flexible, where like everybody's sort of, I wouldn't say we're on the same page, but like there's just sort of this like reverence for there's an intelligence, or there's something that we are a part of here.
There's something transcendent.
Something transcendent, and there's something so much bigger than what our ego wants to like think is important.
Yeah.
And how amazing is it to be in that experience of just fucking being alive? And it, but back to sort of what I think you were talking about, like to be around the seminar table trying to figure out, like parse out and like almost in like legal terms sort out right. what, who and how and what, it's like so not what any of this is, you know?
Yeah.
Or it's exactly what this is, where if like the thing I'm loving about Origin is, which feels so modern and so almost for my vantage point, it almost feels airtight, where there's this reading of it that's basically just describing God as just intellect, which is also very familiar to like an Eastern idea. So if God is just intellect, intelligence, and you could think of like Christ consciousness as like the wisdom, this whole game we play, even wanting to entertain our minds to talk about this, or if you look at the way Thomas Aquinas writes and it's just like these insane inner dialogues, or even Origin, for as airtight and as much as I enjoyed reading it, it's a fucking 500 page tome. It's like, why do that? And it's just like, oh right, do that because if we are all God and we all are this like piece of this intellect, this is our godly nature.
Damn, that was good for me. That was good for me to hear. Also, it feels like my Presbyterian roots are like very much about the written word and about like theology, and like, and you're reminding me of that. I feel like I've just like forsaken some ancestors or something.
No.
But no, it's fine. They're fine with it. But
and it's not forsaking the word.
Well, and you know what you were just talking about brought up for me is like another sensation I had earlier this week, which like, it's really cool if you zoom out a little bit.
Oh yeah.
You know, and if you're like, I'm going to be dust soon, very soon on a relative scale. This is such a blip. This moment right here is such a fucking blip. Me sitting at a seminar table is such a blip, as were the 2,000 years of blips at the time. So to, you know, and I personally, I struggle with the idea that there is a super being that has a consciousness that's observing what's happening.
No.
That doesn't feel right to me. But as like, as in a certain sense, if we are as humanity through theological dialogue, which is now including a lot more comparative theological dialogue as like the next kind of evolution of that, in my opinion, as problematic as we're learning that to be, apparently.
Yes. Pluralism bad.
That's an inside HDS joke.
Isn't that another one of those reverse rebellion things, like suddenly diversity's
problematic.
The devil.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, but I, but so like, okay, so we are kind, it's like a flower, right? And we are just a part of the unflowering process.
Right.
This whole 2,000 year thing since Jesus has just been the unflowering. So there's been parts of it that are weird and kind of wrong and
yeah.
obviously hateful and like causing a lot of suffering,
yes.
so much suffering along the way that can't be ignored either.
Yeah.
I think that is important to remember. And that it's not just a fun part of this hasn't been just a fun exercise.
Well,
there's been a lot of people that have died at the hands of that.
Absolutely.
You know?
And even just more close to home, so many of our peers are so traumatized
yeah.
by their faith, the way they were brought up in the Christian faith.
Absolutely.
I would say most yeah. people I know are traumatized.
Absolutely. And it's like, that's why I don't, even though I get a little, I won't, just in the spirit of candor, sometimes
yeah.
I get annoyed where I'm like, at somebody else having baggage. But then I think I'm like, how can I really be that annoyed at somebody
yeah.
having baggage over Christianity? I mean, I've had baggage around Christianity in my life.
Yeah.
I remember it,
yeah.
you know? I didn't want anything to do with Christianity for most of my
yeah.
20s. And to me, I guess that's what was powerful about, you know, some of my experiences with ayahuasca was that, like, it was very focused on healing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, healing trauma versus, like, dogma and stuff. And there's, like, maybe there is a time, I think there is a time and place for figuring out what's true, what's real. And that's the theological sort of debate, maybe, generally. But there's also a time and place for, like, let's not have that conversation right now. Let's focus on healing the trauma that's within us so that we don't pass it on and
yeah.
through intergenerational trauma.
Which is the edict of Christianity, the rehabilitation. And I was thinking about this today in class because, and again, there are so many obvious lessons. I mean, talk about being a blip and everything just being these like microcosms. Like my little individualized life here, I know is about so many just personal lessons and healings for my own life beyond these like surface games of like, oh, I'm studying this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But a big one for me being here is like relinquishing huge chunks of my ego that were very dominant when I was in New York City, having a tremendous amount of humility and coming back to school and being, you know, novice in so many things.
Yeah, yeah.
But one part that feels I noticed today or in the context of this class and talking about the big rehabilitation, since you brought up like ayahuasca and healing, I wonder if, and I'm 2 years sober and I didn't get sober through the typical Jesus saves kind of way, but it was definitely a divine intervention and like a spiritual experience.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, like to have undergone a rehabilitation, to experience in like carnal life a true rehabilitation, you go back to the scripture and like the message there and it all makes a lot more sense because you sort of have this like science lab in your own life and in your body of what it is to be, dare I say, saved. You know,
that's powerful for me.
But I think I haven't done ayahuasca yet, but from what I understand, that's probably why it hit that nerve.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I haven't drank alcohol since my first ayahuasca ceremony.
Yeah.
And now I wouldn't say that like that was on my mind. I'm like, this is probably something I should do, was leave alcohol behind for good. But that was the final, like, in my very first ceremony, it was very clear, like, this doesn't serve you. And
yeah.
haven't exercised no willpower to not drink it since,
yeah.
to drink alcohol since.
Well, you have exercised willpower just in saying no.
Well, but my point is, though, is that, like, I haven't had to, like, there hasn't been moments where I'm like, ooh, maybe
right.
I could,
right.
or, oh, man, it would be, there have been times of maybe slight regret at, like, a wedding or something
mm-hmm.
where I'm like, oh, this would be fun to kick back,
yeah.
But then it's like, I just know when I think, I'm like, I tap into a higher intelligence,
yeah.
I suppose, where I'm like, this isn't, I know where this leads. I have the data from
right.
my 20s of how this
yes.
leads. And it was but I think it was also grounded in a new sense of, and I, you know, self-love is something that we talk about a lot. And we talk about it a lot in like ayahuasca circles that I've been a part of. And self-love is beautiful. But I also feel, after those ceremonies, I felt loved by something greater than me too. Which you can call the universe, you can call God, you can call Great Spirit, if you're into whatever your theology is, or you know, whatever language works for you. I do think feeling like there is something bigger than me that loves me and my existence, and it's not just me loving myself, but it's being loved.
It goes back to you like describing the blips and like just the fact that we're alive, like, is so okay. So, like, today in class. Again, unpacking origin, and we were specifically looking at this passage about, you know, origin trying to convince that you are worthy of divinity, you're worthy of God, and I was thinking like it so mirrors like our culture's psychology, where we are all consumed with this unworthiness complex. We don't deserve to be alive. We don't deserve to be loved. We don't deserve to be anywhere. We don't And like the message, at least as I'm interpreting this text, is just like, you are alive. Just by being alive means you are worthy to be alive. And like, if you are, even if you are not into God or any of this shit, and you're just like science, DNA, blah, blah, even that scenario, the fact that we are on this earth, that you are alive for just this blip and there's all of this stuff going on, like, you got the ticket in. Like, you own it. You have a body for a very brief bit of time. You deserve to be here if you're here.
Absolutely. You know? And you know, that reminds me of a theory I've been workshopping that I'm sure a professor will like smack me down as to why this is not correct, an oversimplification. But I've been thinking about like, I mean, Buddhism and Christianity are probably the two most influential traditions as far as like my own personal thing I've got going on. And to me, it struck me that like, it seems like they're attacking. What I would say a common human problem is a negative self story, or a negative story in general about the world, or about, but it often includes a negative story about yourself, and negative story about other people, blah blah blah. But like, I shouldn't say blah blah blah, like that's like, you know, whatever. And so it feels like to me that Buddhism approaches that problem of saying like, the story you're telling yourself, it's real in that you're having it, but it's not necessarily true. It's empty, right? It's just a thing. It's just a thought, and the thought's not real just because you're having it.
Right.
And it's just to observe it. So therefore, just practice looking at it. And also, your true identity is essentially emptiness, or a no self is like, you know, I'm butchering and glossing over lots of different opinions within Buddhism about it.
It's a TRL podcast.
Right. You know. Exactly.
Got to keep it light for the kids.
The signs are outside.
In sync.
That was the greatest show for me for like 3 months or a year. I'll say 2 years. Okay, fine. Anyway. Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. No, you're fine. Buddhism. These are great. This is great.
The narrative.
So that's how Buddhism sort of treats that problem, is kind of like poofing the narrative, being like, oh, shit. And it's like, I've certainly had those moments like, oh, right, I'm just telling myself that.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily true. And Christianity, to me, kind of uses the alchemy in a certain sense with the story.
Literary alchemy.
Right, right. And says that, well, whatever your story is, that's not the end of the story.
Right.
And there's always, it doesn't matter how much harm you've caused other people, doesn't matter how much harm you cause yourself, doesn't matter what you've done, doesn't matter who you are, what your story is, God loves you, you're worthy of love, Jesus loves you, and you can rewrite the end of your story.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you are. You can, and if you, it doesn't matter how many times you've rewritten your story.
Right.
Now, to many people,
you have a game genie with infinite lives.
Right. Now, to many people, it seems like I just processed that reference, and I appreciate it. The Super Nintendo Game Genie that stuck out, like
just like a clunker.
5 inches out. Yeah,
I used it for SimCity and gave myself infinite money.
I mean,
anyway,
like a true genie. But like, so like, okay, I lost my train of thought.
I think you were talking about a genie. Did I just make that up? We had sorry.
I don't know.
We did,
it's fine. God loves you. Oh, I was going to say,
yeah.
I was going to say,
infinite lives.
Now it does strike me in the spirit of fairness, it does strike me that people historically have not always felt that that was super satisfying.
Right.
Because they're like, well, people deserve, people who do bad things deserve justice in this life. And also people who are like, it seems like a cop out for bad behavior for to let people just be like, ah, I'm shitty. I don't know how often that actually happens. It doesn't, like, you hear about some random stories of some like, oh, I'll just like ask for forgiveness on my deathbed. I guess it does happen.
Yeah.
But so I get there are some weird loopholes that that creates.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, I don't know, there's something very transcendent and powerful about that message. As far as like when I think about those times in my life when I was like at my lowest self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling the, my most nihilistic and feeling the most unloved and unworthy.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a fucking great message to hear. And it's a great message to feel.
Yeah.
If you can feel it.
But the thing is, which again, back to like having tangible life lab rehabilitation, I don't know that you can wrap your head around it unless you experience it in some way.
Yeah.
I don't think, and that's sort of, you know, a bit of the poverty of being in divinity school, I've noticed, where, for example, I'm also in this Upanishads class. Upanishads are these ancient Vedic texts that, you know, you touch upon in yoga training and meditation, et cetera.
That's awesome.
And so, yeah, I'm like, sign me the fuck up. Can't wait. And it's been really challenging for me because when you're working with those philosophies and readings in a yoga training and in your yoga practice, you are in the lab of the alchemy of the practice. And it even says explicitly, I mean, I one thing I'm trying to learn to, because I think another part of this practice or another part of this experience of being here is like you saying we're going to listen back on this and be embarrassed, like already in just 3 weeks I've realized my errors and my ways of I was about to say, I have this tendency, and it's gotten me in trouble in the past, and I'm starting to recognize that it'll probably get me in trouble here, so I'm, like, taming it back. This, like, broad universalism of, like, oh, yeah, like, Hinduism is saying this is just like Christianity. Jesus is a yogi, and
yeah, no,
Buddhism is the same thing.
I've done the same thing a whole lot.
All the same.
Yeah.
And so, like, now, for the first time in a long time, I'm finally recognizing why that's problematic. But, so, dipping my toe back in that zone, though, the part, you know, where the Upanishads mirrored like the Christian scriptures is like there are these like explicit instructions that you do need to work with this text to get just like kind of some basic wisdom, but that beyond that, like the only way you're gonna tap into this is tapping into your own divinity. And so it's been like the part that feels like impoverished is like it's not as satisfying to sit around a seminar table analyzing a metaphor when like I know from my own living that like you have the divine experience in the living, not in the alternately there are other parts of both scriptures that talk about, and this is something I've actually been grateful for, I feel like whether it's intentional or not, a lot of our professors have like folded into week one reading these texts that sort of glorify the student and the scholar, and how the student, like that great reading we did in Intro to Ministry Studies, the Simone reading, just how, you know, studying is prayer.
Simone Veil,
yeah.
W-E-I-L.
You know how I didn't say it.
Yeah.
So
he pronounced it in
myself.
A way I didn't expect it to. I was like, shit. I think it's Simone Veil. I don't know.
He said
W-E-I-L.
He's jazzed it up a bit, but yeah. But how, you know, just like studying in its own right is a holy practice. Being with text, reading,
cultivating attention,
it's meditation. So like
I did love that text.
That was that whole class is a hug,
and the idea that it's a well needed hug, and the idea that like people really just want to hear what are you going through at the end of the day.
Oh, I love you know?
And just attention like, is love. That's all.
Yes,
that's all it is. I think I've had some thoughts around some similar parallel thoughts of like also realizing like I've been super generalizing my own universalism. and saying, oh, we're all one, it's all one.
Yeah, it's all the same.
And also that, like, it feels like only studying, academically studying divinity is like just talking about sex and being like, oh, I know sex.
Right.
Like, you know, you like meet somebody and you fall in like it versus like,
this is what the body parts do and this is how they advise you to do it.
Right. Well, and not to like belabor this, the ayahuasca thing over and over, even though I very well can do that. But like that was one of the reasons that was a kind of almost a reconversion experience for me was that it was the difference between intellectually knowing God or the universe loves me and feeling it.
Yeah.
And like
yeah.
The difference between as somebody's, some other philosopher described it as like, it's like being able to feel what you know what an apple feels like and what it tastes like.
Right.
You have a certain memory and like really direct contact with that versus being like, okay, an apple is sweet. Like what that doesn't mean anything abstractly.
Yeah.
So anyway, I relate very hard to that. I think what it like, again, another doctrine I'm probably butchering. Divinity School has really driven the humility into me hard.
Isn't it great though? What a gift.
In case that wasn't in case that wasn't clear
no,
earlier.
No, thank God. Literally.
Thank God. gratitude. Yeah. But the two truths doctrine that Buddhism talks about, which is that there are two paradoxical truths. There is relative truth and absolute truth, and like relative truth is focusing on the difference and is protecting us from the dangers of overgeneralizing and is saying like, no, you can't just say Hinduism is even a religion.
Yeah,
as it turns out,
that too.
Because we invented the apparently we did invent the concept of the word religion, of the category religion, and we threw Hinduism kind of in that religion bucket versus it being this kind of, I don't know, a cultural outgrowth of its region. And that's immensely more complicated than I ever realized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an important thing that we do need to focus on. And thank God for Divinity School to remind us of that.
Yeah.
But I do think that I need to always balance that with an absolute truth that Buddhism, I think, describes, which is that simultaneously it's all empty and it's all unified and it's all one. So it's like, yes, there is it's a paradox. It's intentionally a paradox that it's all different and it's all the same.
And
if we're always focusing on it's all different, that's as much of an issue as saying it's all the same.
Yep.
To me. I'm getting better at putting like little personal qualifiers on shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Name tags.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's like, and you know, back to the origin bit of which I recognize the danger, because one part that was being, students were being critical of is you can't just say everybody's saved and like this is no matter what happens, good, bad, ugly, like it's all part of the plan. Like that's such a fucking cop out.
Right.
But it's also like, what is the alternative? And I actually have, this has been coming up very, what's the adjective I want to use? precariously. I've been brave enough to voice this and have like reflected on it and probably going to revert it back to silence and reflect on it some more privately. But since the climate march is tomorrow, and this is like, you know, a zeitgeist of our time right now.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I brought up, devil's advocate E, is just, it's always like perplexing to me at how much we demand that it should be. What is the demand that the planet is supposed to be in perfect health and we're supposed to, and our children are supposed to have a place to live? Like, who told you that? Who told you, where do you have a sense that that's your inheritance or who told you, and this maybe this belongs in like the Buddhism camp of like, who told you that there wasn't going to be suffering or that there shouldn't be suffering and I'm not committed to any of these ideas, but I'm just sort of like.
It's a thought exercise.
Yeah.
You're entertaining the thought without advocating for it per se.
Yeah. Because like on one hand, I do align with the thinking that my life appears to be, and I'm assuming the other players that are here with me, we do seem to be in some kind of educational moment. And I mean our whole lives. And if we're going to get mystical, probably multiple lifetimes. But we do seem to be in some kind of here to learn something, here to grow, here to heal situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, somebody like Origen will say the reason, and this is like the pit of the argument where like maybe an atheist will say, how on earth would there be a God if my 3-year-old died of leukemia? Like, what kind of God would allow that to happen? And then there's like this rift of like, that's who promised you that?
Right.
Who promised you anything? And
right.
How do we make sense of anything we're doing here? I don't know. I'm talking a bit in circles.
No. So I think what my reaction is there is a certain, like with Zen, with my Zen kind of leanings of my 20s, there was there was something about like, and I guess this goes along with almost some Roman stoicism,
mm-hmm.
which love. Is like
Marcus,
just learning Waller. To accept what is and reality for what it is and yeah. realizing that, oh, shit, sometimes it's not great.
Yeah.
Now, I think as far as it putting it in the context of like social action, I think a danger of that is just being like, I don't need to improve anything because
right.
life sucks. but no, and I think there is a real... There are very legitimate theological reasons to say like, well, I need to help ease suffering of people
yes.
in this lifetime, and literally if nobody does it, then
right.
I have to do whatever I can.
Right.
Now that doesn't
necessarily
now what that exactly looks like is going to be different from everybody as far as like what specific we only have so much time and attention
right.
and ability and resources, so we can't all fix everything. If we could fix everything ourselves, then everything would be fixed, right?
Yeah, I almost feel like my temptation to entertain the opposite of that is like a reaction to the clearly unhealthy, I'm going to drive everybody, I'm going to fix everything kind of... Like the panic of like the weight of the world, I have to fix everything. You do fix it, but you fix what you can do right in front of you.
Right.
And that is how right. you save the world.
And, you know, I'm sure a lot of those people would say, well, doing what's in front of me is going to the climate strike, you know, for them.
Totally.
You know, I'm just playing devil's advocate now back to, they're not, you know, nobody's the devil.
Yeah. Well, we all are, because we're all fallen.
Mm.
Hey.
Yeah, one thing I do love, and I think this is also present in Buddhism, and from what I understand, why a lot of, you know, Buddhist monks don't become ordained by going to a place like here.
Right. right?
This is kind of superfluous studies for a lot of Buddhists.
Yeah.
Like they become monks through like being monastic and
right.
like going through that kind of formal training, right? But they, from what I understand, talking to a couple of our Buddhist students here, is that they don't want a quietist. They don't want the Buddhism in a cave.
In
they want to
yeah.
right. They and because they recognize there's something missing about that, and they want to
yes.
be out in the world. I think Thich Nhat Hanh was one of the main espousers of this. Of
yeah.
like he had an experience, I think during the Vietnam War, where he just realized, oh, I need to be like out there in the world. Doing things, and then, you know, and Jesus kind of makes a similar point, right?
Absolutely.
Jesus is like
an activist.
Jesus, yeah. So he's like, yeah, fucking. It's not like, yeah, you'll be. I mean, so my Christian interpretation of it would be like, you will. We're all loved. It's not always going to be perfect, but it still is like one way you actually can come to love and come to experience God is through helping other people.
Yes,
and is through doing what you can. Now, I do think now. Something I struggle with is like where anger takes a place in all of this. And I have learned that there's actually, I thought for a while we had agreed that anger was was a bad thing, but apparently
it's a precious commodity.
It's precious. And I,
but it's very, go on.
Well, one way I heard it framed to me that was new to me that I'm probably going to mischaracterize, but I'll give it my best faith shot is that this person was Jewish, and they said anger, a certain amount of holding on to anger, they thought was actually part of their theology in a certain sense of like not forgetting injustice and not letting people like being like, this is important to remember and to like honor people, ancestors that have been wronged, and to honor those people. And it's not just going to be hunky dory. I don't personally, I think it's, and I guess I suppose it might be easy for me to say this, but it feels like it's, there's something more transcendent and powerful and transformative about through forgiveness. I mean, personally, in my own life, the people I've forgived and have, it's been really fucking challenging to.
Yeah.
I have felt much more empowered by that, whereas staying angry and upset at them felt like I was their prisoner and their captive to a certain degree. They were living rent-free in my head, as they say.
Yes. Yeah.
You know? And it just it's felt wiser to me when I have done the work of forgiving people. And it's resulted in, I think, me being a better overall person to people in my life. I don't know.
Forgiveness is, it's no, I remember experiencing this for the first time consciously of like, I was like, wow, they weren't lying about forgiveness. That is some shit. When you properly forgive someone, and it doesn't happen with any fanfare usually or any exerted effort, it just sort of is very divine when it happens, but you experience the way in which it just sort of levels everything.
Yeah.
But anger, I find, it's this precious commodity in the sense, it's almost like, we go back to like Game Genie, if I'm thinking like a video game, like sometimes you need that mushroom or the thing that kind of like surges you up to get to the peak.
Yeah.
But you need to use it to get where you're going, and then it needs to go away.
Yeah.
So it was described almost as like a boat, and you take the boat across the river, and then you just leave the boat and you keep going because, you know, it's nobody trains us how to use it effectively. And I think, and we're seeing this a lot now where, women especially are trained not to even touch and tap into it, that you have to be, it's okay to be sad and quiet, but like, God forbid you're angry. And that's, we're seeing that sort of pour out now and in unresolved ways.
Yeah.
But I think, and then I'm also thinking, it's such a natural. It's a natural, and this is probably taking a lot of liberty. I was going to say, therefore, good quality. Like, I'm thinking, I was having these like minor experiences. I always look for the wisdom in like very minor experiences.
Yeah,
like one time
yeah.
I turned the sink on and the water came out just like scalding hot. And I got so like in an instant, just blood curdling, angry, like pulled my hair. I roared. And then I realized that's my body's defense mechanism. Like I got so for an instant, like violently enraged to protect myself. And of course that wouldn't serve me beyond getting my hand out of the water, but fuck, it served me in that moment. And so like, that's where it belongs, you know?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny, even though you did have anger at an inanimate object, I can't remember who said it, but somebody recently framed it as like, it is funny when you notice the difference in your anger when you think somebody has screwed you over then versus realizing like, oh, it was just an accident. Like it was just an accident of Nate. Like, oh, they left the milk out or they left something out. Like, oh, I left the milk out.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, and then the anger, it's not the thing you're even mad about.
Right.
It's what you perceive as the transaction that happened or whatever. And I do think there is what I mean, there's the classic example of Jesus being angry in the temple, right? He wasn't.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. So there's,
I don't know anything.
There's the classic Jesus is pissed example is him like turning over the table of the money changers. Yeah, he gets
that
the
ass.
There are money changers in the temple. The temple had gotten commodified, and he was pissed about it. And he said, "You're a bunch of hucksters, basically." You know, in his own words. I think that's what he said. I haven't taken Greek, but I think that's what he said.
That's pretty much
obvious. So anger, I mean, has a biblical basis. It's also other. There's a lot of wiser people than me have talked about anger, and I'm just doing my best to distill it, what has made sense to me.
Yeah.
And there's also, I think, there is often a righteous anger in the best way. That's kind of what that Jesus moment is illustrating of, like, at injustice, right? And there is times when anger,
it's honest.
And it's not just, it can be injustice of something you've experienced. It can be injustice that you perceive. And when it happens, I feel like it should be kind of... to me, when it's righteous, it feels like it has less of an egoic flavor to it, and it has it's more like a pure... of a zoomed out, like, this isn't right.
Right.
This is just not right. And even when I'm calm and not in the heat of the anger,
right.
I can still say this is not right. Now, the problem is I think often we can really, really... not have a full grasp of the diagnosis of what's causing an unjust situation to happen or who caused an injustice or what caused them to act. You know, when you, I think the more information we get, compassion tends to make sense even in the midst of anger. Now that's, and now as far as like using anger as a tool in your own life, oftentimes I feel like I have had to use and rely and trust my anger of like, my boundaries are being violated here. This isn't right.
It's a signal.
I need to stand up for myself. And I've done that a handful of times, and it's been hard. I was like, I was not taught to honor my anger a whole
lot.
None
of us were. We don't have good mentors.
And we don't have good practice, therefore, doing it. And I also think in a culture where we I don't know what the exact balance should be. It feels like there's a balance. It feels like there's a dance to be involved with like how much anger. You know, there's a certain percentage of anger and also apologizing and forgiveness. And I don't feel like we have enough of on the forgiveness side of thing culturally. So it feels like if there's more of a culture of forgiveness, then maybe it's easier to express anger and be like, oh, I'm sorry.
Or the way we sort of glorify anger as sort of this devout, pious anger that lasts for a lifetime, which is like, I will never forgive you for that. And we somehow sort of glorify that as being like true and devout. And it's just like, oh, like that is so destructive.
Well, and we've gotten away from the apology being holy too, and apologies are seen as kind of weak, as like a sign of like social lowering in a certain sense. I think people see it that way. I mean, when I was like in my 20s, you would kind of be like, you would see an apology as like a sign of admission that they were wrong, and people reject apologies all the time. Like how many apologies are like, that's not enough. I don't know. It's a weird, and it's hard because the source of even the rejection of the apology is also trauma and is also hurt and pain. You can't exactly say they're wrong to not forgive somebody, but
that's why forgiveness is so miraculous, because when you do that, and you're right, it's just like, I just let myself off the hook. I just let everybody off the hook. And how amazingly powerful and healing is that? Because only you decide, you know, again, the living rent free, only you decide how much you're going to allow something to continue to bother you. And the second you sort of like forgive it, you let everybody off the hook.
Well, and I think forgiving other people is, it is often illogical in some sense.
It's super
counter. It says, I don't care about the transaction of who wronged who. It's good. It's all good. And that, I mean, if you ever read some of those, like, these are always one of my favorite stories, like those, like, person being sentenced for a murder and the family's forgiving them and they're pleading for them not to get sentenced to death.
Yeah.
Or they're like, we totally forgive you. We know you did this horrible thing to our family member, but when you read that and it's genuine, it gives me fucking chills.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like,
wow,
there is something powerful they're speaking to, which is breaking the cycle of redemptive violence.
Right. Something that's been like exciting for me to feel viscerally is back to, you know, the monastics deciding, you know, I'm not supposed to be up here on this mountaintop. I'm supposed to be in the world. And part of a big drive to come to divinity school was like, yeah, I'm going to put my, I'm feeling called to be doing something that's serving people and serving people in a way that's not so obvious or so still lost in this realm of ego of how I think I can, even begin to fathom how I might be of aid to anybody. But coming here, for me personally, it was a big part of it was like the things I recognize in life, the like big moments of be it a birth or a death or a marriage or the parts of life that are just so, or the parts that are completely tragic or completely elated, like those to me are just like such hotbed life moments. And there needs to, I want to be attendant to those. And people need people to be attendant to those. And I recognized that I was already doing that, and I wanted to just sort of like acknowledge and come into that more officially and be like, okay, like people need people to stand up here and give a speech at a funeral. People need somebody to make sense of this part of their life that makes no sense, or not to make sense of it, but to, you know, muse about why it doesn't make sense. That's our intro to ministry class. Caution coming out. But then at the same token, it's very, because I think when you tell people you're going to divinity school, they like cock their head at you and they're like, what are you going to become, like a priest? Like, what is this about? But they're also very curious, and something that I don't think many people recognize, I don't even know that I was fully aware of it till really coming and visiting here and enrolling here, just how activist driven it is, that this is a path of action. And that, I know in one of like our flyers, it showed like a bunch of divinity kids locked arm at Charleston, or yeah, at Charleston. And that was like, not Charleston, Charlottesville. And just being like, oh yeah, this is frontline stuff. This is frontline work.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
Frontlines are ugly though too. And
say what?
Frontlines are messy.
Yeah. And it seems like, and a lot of that is like, is very challenging for me. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think a thing I say a lot is quoting this musician, David Lamont, that I know and love. And he talks about like his community should be challenging. The communities he looks for are challenging and nourishing. And if they're not one or the other, it's probably not the right community. So if it's only ever nourishing, if you're only just nourishing each other in a cave, and not going out there and fighting for other people and taking a stand for other people in whatever way, to the best of your ability, to the best of your specialty too. I mean, we, the beautiful thing about the human race is that we all have, we can all specialize in certain things. And we, if we try to generalize, we'll probably be less successful than if we all just figure out what our specific thing can be.
One of my favorite yoga teachers would often say, and I don't think it's unique to him, but choose yourself. Everybody else is taken.
Like, yeah, like, yeah.
Everyone else is taken.
Yeah. And I don't know. And sometimes I like, sometimes I, it's helpful for me to remember just how much pain everybody's in. Like, all the time, I think. It seems like the Buddha was on to something, maybe, when he talked about suffering. Maybe he had some good ideas.
Fine. Well, this is not to take it down a rung, but I wanted to bring this up a couple times in our conversation where it kind of relates back to anger and just sort of like the minor practices. So I ride a bike to campus every day. And I'm not like, I wasn't like an avid cyclist ever. And I've noticed, I love it. I sit on the bike and within a minute, I'm just like in this elevated state and it's become one of my favorite practices here. But I notice how I'm very keenly aware of how I engage with other drivers on the road. And for the most part around here, this is a very bike friendly place. But you know, inevitably there's precarious moments and I find my brain want to lurch into that like stereotypical angry cyclist mode of being like, what are you doing, man? Come on. Like somebody almost doored me today. And I'm sort of like, oh, like,
what
like,
is it about traffic that makes us that way?
Shamed. Yeah. Well, but then you know what my mantra has come to be. And it's like my new, it's a mini spiritual bit. Every time something happens and I kind of like have to, you know, think quick and want to like shame or judge a driver, I just think, you know, everybody's doing the best they can.
They are.
Like I've been the driver and have sort of glanced over and like, oh, whoa. Like everybody's just doing the best they can.
Definitely. Definitely. Are you familiar with Don Miguel Ruiz at
the
all?
Four Agreements.
Four Agreements, yeah. And the like the longer
Mastery of Love.
Yeah. So you know Donnie Miguel.
I know Donnie.
And Don is a title. It's that's the worst part about that joke. but in like the in his, I don't know if it's a preface. It's like, I think it's like a whole chapter or two to the four agreements. He just talks about like everybody's got like sickness in them, basically. Yeah. We're all like, there's a lot of shit we're all dealing with. And there is something about healing, about mere attention, about being with somebody, about being just being present with people, that is far more impactful than me like saying fucking anything to them.
Exactly.
And oftentimes, I was actually, as have you read the Ambrose reading?
I was
yet?
Just going to bring it up. I started it, and you have to be, it's first rule,
shut
silent.
The fuck up, basically, yep. Right?
And I stop talking.
And that kind of, you know, raises some questions about what we're doing on, what am I doing with having a podcast? what damage have I done? I mean, but, you know, I
people love podcasts. This they is their
do.
Education.
They do.
/ social. Isn't it amazing how reassuringly amazing how popular podcasts are?
It's fascinating.
It's like it's so retro. It's like people sitting by the radio, like that's something that we, more so than listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
Of course people love TV. We're in a golden age of that era of that, but like I'm so like reassured and happy that people want to listen to people talk.
It's a fascinating, I mean, the internet has just enabled that like God flowering conversation, yeah, thing we were talking about earlier. Like it just enables that to happen at so much more of a rapid speed than it used, and it allows every much more voices to be a part of that,
yeah,
than ever were before. Yeah. Nobody would have ever allowed me to speak in public. This would not be happening. I do, maybe this is, I've been wanting to ask you about your music. We haven't
Shoot.
Even gotten to it.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good pivot to go from like, cause there is something about music that isn't, I mean, it often involves talking, kind of melodic talking, but it's not, yeah, really, it's not really talking. It's
no,
something different.
But it is communion. It is, yeah, like a communication.
What is, so also I'm curious, I'll throw out some, maybe, I don't know if this is even the right approach. I'm like fascinated about having an alter ego. Whether is Izzy Dean an alter ego? Is it a stage name? What is that? Or what is that? It,
yeah,
sounds like a terrible
what
way to
that?
Phrase. Or what is it? Yeah. So I'm curious about that. I'm curious about how you got into music, about your whole relationship with the creative process. There's just a lot. There's a lot.
Yeah.
And there are also, I do want to say, I do legit love your music. I was like,
thanks,
as I was walking,
I legit love it too.
I was like, fuck yeah. I was like listening to it all day today, and I was like, I did prepare for this podcast. Somebody prepared. But I was
showing up in the present.
No, you're great. You're great. But I was like, as I was walking here, I'm just like drumming the air, and I'm like, this
cool.
isn't, I was like, this is music that feels like I'm not, I was like, feels like I'm accomplishing my goals. No, fuck it. It feels like I'm accomplishing my dreams.
Yes.
This music. Like it's fucking enlivening and all this stuff. But so tell me your story.
This relates to divinity in a lot of ways because, so I probably started making music when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And my dad was a drummer. So we had an electronic drum kit in our house and he was a big audiophile. So there was always a lot of music in my house, but I never had any real proper training or lessons, but I was very inclined to make music from a very, very young age. I was played drums when I was 10. All through middle school, I was into like the pop punk of the era. I started with a drum set. I got a bass guitar. I got an electric guitar. I got a 4-track, and I learned how to make these multi-track, like punk rock songs on my own. And that was like my favorite thing to do. And then in like high school, I played bass in this hardcore band and. But essentially what it boils down to is I got to a point, but I wasn't fostered or supported by people that said that recognize, and that this is actually breaks my heart. I know I have this inexplicable, and I'm not like virtuosic. I don't know what I'm doing. But I clearly have a musical talent, and I wish, maybe I don't wish because everything worked out just fine and it's working out great. But I wish somebody had recognized that when I was 7 and like cultivated it for me. But that's not how it worked out. Instead, it worked out that I like was also equally interested in like writing and books.
Yeah.
And was very, I had some, you know, typical life trauma happen in my early teens. And fortunately, the coping mechanisms I really hung on to were making music and overachieving in school. And those were sort of my two. And they all were both about getting attention. I remember being in seventh grade and like a bunch of people. Like I had a year where I was like getting attention in really gnarly ways. And then my school would have these like assemblies where whoever got straight A's would come up on the stage and get like standing ovation applause. And I was just like, I fucking want that. So I like did really well in school so I could be up on stage and get the applause, which is the same thing, sort of, you know, a musical. Well, music, the making music thing, there's, I'd be lying to say, because there's the performing of the music and there's the making of the music. The making of the music is a very solitary, very spiritual, very meditative, isolated, creative thing. And I learned from a very young age how I could like lock myself in a room. 12 hours would go by. I wouldn't need to eat. I wouldn't need to do anything. I was just in the song. So anyway, but I was on this academic track. So I did really well in school. I got into college, which was a big deal for my family because I don't come from educated family. And was sort of just like, yeah, I'm making all this music, but I can't do that for a living. So I'll be an English teacher, a writer. And had a nice run with that. Had a big chip on my shoulder and thought, oh, now I'm going to get a PhD and become a literature professor. It didn't work out that way.
Mm.
Close friend from childhood, I was one of my early musical collaborators, got melanoma and was like very quickly deteriorated. And I attended his bedside and his deathbed, you know, and that was life changing. And decided that summer, which was 10 years ago, it was just like, oh, I don't have to go to school. Like, I can do what I want. And I sort of had this, like, epiphany of, like, everything I'm doing or everything I've been doing has been to sort of, like, appeal to others or to do what I think other people want me to do. But when I really, like, reflect on what was the thing that I was doing naturally from as my earliest memories, and it was making music. And I sort of had this idea, like, there's no explanation for this. Like, this is like this has to be some kind of God download. And if I don't explore this, it's an affront to God.
Mm.
So that sort of like that was the impetus to like get serious about it. So
wow.
I gave myself initially, I was like, I'm going to give myself 5 years. I'm really going to go for it. I had had many monikers over the years, and Iggy Dean at the time, I don't even remember. How did I? Oh yeah. Iggy Dean. It just totally random the way everything is. But, actually just had fried green tomatoes for dinner tonight, which was so good. I bring that up because there's the movie/book Fried Green Tomatoes has a character, Iggy Threadgood, who I identified with. So, and one of my close friends at the time would call me Iggy, and she was like, Iggy Dean, you're like James Dean and Iggy Threadgood rolled into one, like this masculine feminine badass. And I was just like,
I love that.
I was like, oh, I kind of like that. I do regret naming myself that though, because nobody, for whatever reason, understands it. They're like, is it Igby? But anyway,
I thought it was a cool name when I first heard it.
Yeah, it's the name. I didn't choose it for myself. That's sort of how I feel about it at this point.
Those and are
I
the just, best names too, in a certain way.
But I went for it, and the 5 years flew by, and like every time I thought I might be at like a roadblock, something would kind of blow up and give me another tank of gas to ride on. And so that was sort of that was a 10-year long road trip.
Wow.
And then I recently, before coming here, did this whole performance art funeral to kill Iggy Dean, which felt like the right thing to do because I needed to like have a little ego death, and I wanted to sort of like wrap up something before starting this
bizarre chapter. Yeah.
But you know, and I said that night, and I know in my heart, like I couldn't not make music if I tried. And the thing I love about making music is that it just feels so much like the truth. Mm. And like when you're making, and okay, let's get back to divinity, like God's creating out of love. Like when I'm making music, like it is just so infused with me doing it because I love to do it. And unfortunately, especially in the last couple of years, because I got kind of on the track of like, oh, this is my career, this is my profession, I need to be successful in this, it loses some of its, you can feel sort of like the loss of magic.
Mm.
And so I think another hope I have of coming here is to kind of like do this like reverse course and remove myself a little bit from the hustle and the rat race of it, so that I can give myself the space to like make music the way I did when I first started making music.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
I just was listening to this record yesterday, Life Tones.
Mm-hmm.
God bless Discover Weekly, and I swear they're like listening to my conversations. But Life Tones was this like, I just learned about them yesterday, but they were like a side project spinoff of this band in the early 80s. They made this one 6-song record and it disappeared for like 20 years.
Wow.
And then there was like some people that knew about it and like advocated to like get it re-released. And it's like a very simple, unsophisticated, but truly honest, truthful, divine message thing. And I was listening to it yesterday. I was just like, now this is like the kind of record I want to get back to making, like just telling the truth and doing it in a way that has the freedom of being abstract and I mean, you got me started, so I could like literally talk about this forever.
Yeah.
But the thing too that's so special about music, especially when you're performing it live, is like everybody's in real time as it's happening. It's not like, here's this dead artifact, have fun with it. Because even when you're listening to the recording where I'm absent, I'm not absent because you start it at a certain moment and there's, say, 3 to 7, 9 minutes that you are attendant. And there, it's a in real time experience.
Energy exchange,
vibration. Mm-hmm. Like, and there's another interesting detail is, it's eerie to me. There's many lyrics of mine that I've written that have become almost like prophetic, where years later I'll like listen to them and I'll find a way in which they've like manifested. And to me, that just like contributes. Like, yeah, it's incanting. You're chanting these things and you're in the beginning was the word. You're creating existence out of it. So.
Mm. That's
anyway,
fascinating.
I'm rambling on.
No,
what,
you're.
Did I
you're,
touch all the points?
No, you did. You hit all the points. Yeah, something about like to me when you're like it's like telling the truth. I think too, it's like sometimes the abstraction and like telling the truth doesn't have to be as like in that sense of like I'm describing a literal thing.
Yeah, and we obviously like, talk about all the time the poverty of words. Of course, there's words and lyrics and music, but like. It's so nice that I can say something with a drum instead of saying something with a saying.
Well, this is something that, again, to tie it back to my ayahuasca experiences, I really did get like a sense of like, I remember having a sense of closeness to ancient human ancestors of like what people might, or just imagining pre-language civilization, whatever that looks, whatever the fuck, or not, it wasn't even civilization, just pre-language human living, or like, and people still, there was some kind of love that was happening, right, and there was some kind of, there were, you know, I don't know the history of drumming, but I think drumming has been around for a long ass time, and there's still,
well, we all have one inside of us, so.
Ooh. That's good. That is good.
I get like so annoyed when people are like, I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't drum. It's just like you have a metronome inside of you.
Yeah, and it's like there's something about music and the vibration within music and with drumming that's like a certain kind of like, you know, rhythmic vibration that feels like it arrives before your mind gets there, before your mind gets in the way and like starts analyzing it to death and starts analyzing this whole situation to death. Mm-hmm.
It's definitely the most visceral and primal.
People have been less harmed by music than they have by words, I think.
Yeah, I think about how much people have been healed by music. I mean,
so many. I mean, myself included. And that's why it's like,
everyone.
in ceremonial practices and work, it's often music that's the vehicle for healing too, yeah. And is the method itself. I definitely always, and I always wanted to be a musician growing up, and I never really felt like I had that any kind of talent. I mean, and I didn't like playing piano. I was forced to play piano.
That's the problem, right?
Right. I almost had a reverse experience, yeah. Whereas like my mom wished she was trying to nurture it. She's got to cultivate it. I'm like, I don't want to fucking. I learned how to play the Star Wars theme. That's like nice. All I really like enjoyed how to play on piano. And then like 2 years after I quit, Ben Folds gets huge, and like I'm like, I could have gotten girls through this. I didn't know what the fuck.
Careful what you wish for. your musicianship also. I hate this narrative, and I'm working very hard to rewrite it, but. Dooms you to solitude and loneliness and despair, and it seems that in choosing in boldly committing to the path of artistry, you sacrifice the householder bit.
I don't have that experience.
And obviously there's plenty of artists who are
I had through ceremonial experiences. One of the most powerful things for me was actually discovering that I have a voice that is connected to my soul, and it's not just like a thing to either be good or bad at.
Yeah.
It's a part of me. It's a part of my, it's a way to express something that is truer than even the words I'm saying. It's expressing a tone. It's expressing an emotional connect. It's like a soulful connection between heart and mind and spirit. Right. And I've been so blessed with being able to play songs in ceremonial context since then. And that inspiration got me to like practice my guitar. And now I play, you know, just a diddle around on an acoustic guitar now. But that's like that's one of my most important daily spiritual practices is doing that. And it's the weird thing about music too, is that it's so much more powerfully tied in my memory and easily accessed through my memory than most word-based things.
Oh, yeah.
I forget shit all the time about like what I said, like, you know, whatever, but like songs fucking stick with you.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
they're sacred. And even like, even the songs that you wouldn't presume to be sacred. I mean, we so underappreciate and undervalue what these 3 to 6 minute things do. And I think
I'm a Fish fan, so it's like 20 minutes.
No, yeah. So, I mean, it's all one big long noise arrangement. It's also, you know, it would be so lovely to get to just make music, but this is another chat. And this even, I don't even know if I feel connected to this anymore. This feels like an old lament, because I feel like I'm past this bit of being like, oh, it'd be nice to do music, but I can't afford to live that life. It's just like, yes, you can. Your whole life has been making music, that's not an excuse. Same as that, there's no excuse to not do anything that you're called to do.
Yeah, it's like just.
And there's also no wrong way to do anything that you're called to do. I think that's what trips us up, me especially, is like thinking, oh, I need to do this to a certain appraisal moment, and that's just not true. You know, it's our jobs here, I think, are to approach the things that resonate the most truth for us, and the closer we get to doing that, I think we're doing a great job.
Yeah, and like that involves. The call might be there for us, and it's about being a better listener to what that call is.
And here's another, and another thing that I'm learning as I'm like becoming a more mature artist is understanding like a tricky part about like making the things you make in your 20s and early 30s is you're still very much tied up in your own identity around it, and it's this sort of like idea that it belongs to you or that you own something, and realizing that like. And this isn't like a new idea that you have while you're making it, but like once you make the thing you make, it's no longer yours. Yeah. And thank God. I mean, of course, it's, you know, means something to you because you gave birth to it. But like, even just, I mean, hearing you say that you were listening to my music is makes me so happy. And I heard from somebody just last night who I don't know, who just reached a stranger that reached out to me being like, hey, I just lost a close friend of mine and I just was listening to your record and it means so much to me. Thank you for making it.
Wow.
And like that,
wow.
That's rare. It doesn't happen all the time. Man, when it happens, it really, that one little message from a stranger like makes it all worth it. You know? Because
yeah.
Then you think like, okay, like this, because the part of you that I think when you grow up and you make that switch where you're like, okay, this was fun being in this little incubator. I was doing everything sort of self-centeredly for a while, but like now I kind of want to like turn face outward. And this was a definitive shift with the identity of Iggy Dean. Cause like for a long time, Iggy Dean for me represented my maximum self. And I, you know, we're always striving, or at least I am always striving to be like my maximum self. And Iggy Dean was like my pinnacle version of my being. And then I outgrew it.
Right.
It was just like, well, I like this too. And I like this too. And Iggy Dean doesn't accommodate all of that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I need something that's going to accommodate all of that.
And I felt similar things with aspects of comedy or storytelling or now I didn't necessarily, I don't know if I ever actually reached the peak comedian I could have been. I don't think I ever quite did, but I part of that was like feeling that I was called to something else as I was like going through it and feeling it didn't quite align in some important ways. But, you know, one thing too, I was just thinking about, like, I don't know why I was like, I feel like a part of me has been like feeling like I didn't give people a fair enough shake with like with, I didn't give the angry people a fair enough shake or like, you know, our beloved activists that we have here.
Yeah.
And I think I'm like, also, I'm getting a little bit disjointed because what you were saying about like it no longer belongs to you. It's like part of a conversation, right? And it's like putting a piece of art out in there in the world. It's an offer, and then you also have to realize people get the chance to fucking talk back, and they are gonna. And sometimes that response will be beautiful and like feeling
validating.
Good. But then sometimes they'll be like, I'm gonna give my piece of the conversation just like. I was not into that, which sucks to hear. But
and it's also contributive to goal to growth and
it does, yeah. You know, and it's like to use good old Pauline language to bring old Paul, old problematic Paul, into it. There is that like beautiful description of the body of Christ that's like, you know, the eyes. My distance from like. the passage and my distance from Christianity that I had for most of my 20s is showing because I can't remember exactly how beautifully he phrased it, but like basically we all have to be the best. We're all, every part is important in the body of the church and the body of humanity. We each have a special role to play, and I can't be you. I can't do the things that you're doing because we don't need a clone of you. We're all different. We're all special. We all have very special gifts. And so We need our angry people. We need people who actually cheat to be more angry. We need people who will be like more easily, like more sensitive to injustice being perceived. Now, I would also say maybe they need other people too to be like, maybe not all of it is. Maybe we can heal. We can work together. Yeah. But in a holistic picture, we do all need each other.
Yes.
And we need to work together and realize we're all on the same team.
Yeah.
We can all be
We're
working
all worthy
together.
Of being here. Yeah.
And the more we can focus on like common goals and shared goals and remembering and appreciating each other's differences and appreciating each other's skills and passions and like in Enneagram terms, in terms of realizing, oh, people have different core drives and motivations and emotional pains too. And I think we can get a better sense of cohesion about stuff. Anyway.
Yeah.
I felt satisfying to like, yeah.
Yeah.
I felt good for me.
Cheers, man.
is there anything, I feel like we're at a good wrap up point. Do you feel good?
What are your closing curiosities, remarks?
I don't have any rote ones lately. I don't have any. I used to like make up a religion at the end. The first like
a makeup.
In the first year of this podcast, I would make up a religion at the end of each episode. I kind of outgrew that. Where can people find your music? Where can they find you? Okay, and can I include, not to put you on the spot, I'll cut this out if I can't. Like, can I include some music at the front and the back end?
Yeah, for sure.
This?
Yeah.
I feel like it adds a certain amount of context to this.
No, definitely.
Conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. This is weird. I just had this like, I mean, I'm getting tired, so I feel like I'm going into like dreamscape, but I just had this flash of an idea that I feel like I'm in an afterlife because I threw this... The killing of Vigidin was a very elaborate performance. So I had this whole literal funeral ceremony and it was amazing. But now it's been, so to be like, feeling this like echo of like promoting Vigidin almost feels like a weird, like lucid dream moment. Anyway, I'm getting a little
you're
trippy.
Fine. You're right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Because I had a friend. This is a bizarre, random anecdote, but a dear friend gifted me a new wallet before coming here, and I like my old wallet was just like full of stuff that shouldn't have been in my wallet, including like tons of like Vigidin business cards. And when they were like coaching me to like Marie Kondo my wallet, they're like, "Well, you don't need those anymore." And I was just like, "What?" Like, just because I'm taking a moment of hiatus of not performing live all the time, I of course still want people to listen to my music.
Yeah,
like, that is. Those are permanent.
Hell yeah.
Appreciable. Is that a word?
Yeah.
They
sure.
can appreciate. They are things that will live for whomever they need to live for. That's like forever.
Hell yeah.
And also, it's been interesting to just observe. Like, I've definitely had a few moments in recent weeks of almost like a suffocation of being like, I need to figure out how to make some music right now because I can't. I cannot live my life without making music, but I'm excited to figure out a completely different way. Anyway, long story short, yes, you can include the music.
Awesome. Oh, I have an idea for a gimmick I want to do for more other students I want to have on.
Yes.
What's a message that you would like to give to yourself as you graduate?
Ooh.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, if I graduate. I think I will because I think I really like it here. And I'm going to, unless something...
What's a message to you in 3 years?
We'll just put it to me in 3 years.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me tap in to a self, deeper self. Just the beginning.
I love that.
Just getting started. You ain't seen nothing yet.
I love that.
That is how I kind of truly feel now. And isn't it pretty epic that this is just the beginning?
Well, that's what I know Sharon Salzberg says it a lot. Yeah. One of my favorite meditation teachers is that the whole practice of meditation and yoga is just beginning again.
Yep.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This is
great.
Yay.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Check out our new podcast,
Barely Composed,
with us,
Femini Trio.
Each week, we write a brand new comedic song with one of our funny friends.
Listen and subscribe to Barely Composed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Campfire Media.
Campfire.